Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is June 14th, 2020, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is, She Got the Fever. But does she need an LP, antibiotics, or an admission? And our guest skeptic is Dr. Dennis Wren. He is a pediatric emergency medicine fellow at Children's National Hospital in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the SJAM, Dennis.
Thank you so much, Ken. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you've got to give a little backstory to the SJAMers. How did you and I connect? What's the common individual that put us together?
That would be Dr. Michael Falk, who happens to be an attending where I work, and he used to be in New York.
Yeah, he did. And he reached out to me and said, listen, I've got this superstar fellow. He's interested in podcasting, knowledge translation, and would like to do a show. And of course, I said, sounds great. And here we are. So what got you interested in podcasting?
I used podcasts a lot when I was a resident. I actually started listening to Pete's Rap pretty early on and just realized, wow, this is such a great modality for transmitting information. And I think especially now in the era of COVID, where information seems to be just evolving so rapidly, I found that these free online medical education resources have been invaluable for me to kind of keep up with everything that's going on. And the fact that they are peer-reviewed makes them good quality education resources for people.
Yeah, it has been like drinking from the fire hose at times with all the COVID-19 information. So I'm so happy that there are high quality FOMED resources out there like Rebel EM, like St. Emlyn's, like Academic Life in Emergency Medicine, the First 10 AM. And I can't rhyme off all of them because I like to keep these podcasts to about 20 minutes. But thank you to the FOMED world for stepping up and helping filter in a post-publication peer review format. So I really appreciate it. But that's enough banter. Don't want to go down the COVID rabbit hole. Let's get on to a case for this episode of the SJAM.
All right. So our case this time is a five-week-old full-term female that comes to the emergency department because she has a fever and her rectal temp is 100.6 Fahrenheit or 38.1 Celsius. Her mother is saying that she has been fussier today, and she always just seems, quote, congested, and is not feeding as well. She continues to have the usual number of wet diapers. Her mother is worried that her baby is sick, and she wants to know whether or not they will need a spinal tap or antibiotics, or will she need to plan to stay in the hospital and be admitted?
Well, fever without a source in infants less than 3 months of age represents a significant diagnostic dilemma for clinicians. Now, there are several criteria that have been developed previously, including the Rochester, Boston, and Philadelphia criteria. They're all American cities. Anyways, they're set to help clinicians stratify the risk of serious bacterial infections.
And febrile infants seem to very commonly be a presentation in the emergency department. It's estimated that about 8 to 13% of these infants may have an SBI that includes urinary tract infections, bacteremia, and bacterial meningitis. It's really, really hard to identify which infants have an SBI by clinical examination alone. One of the things that I was taught very early on is that all babies are liars, so we cannot trust our clinical exam alone. There are obviously serious consequences if we miss an SBI, but in the process of working up an SBI, that can often include lumbar punctures, empiric antibiotics, and hospitalization.
And when you're saying SBI, just so everybody's clear who's listening, that stands for serious bacterial infection. And these criteria, the Rochester, Boston, and Philly, could be considered out of date in our current era of vaccination. And we covered a new protocol called Step by Step Approach on SJAM number 171. And this step-by-step rule combined with clinical factors and laboratory factors in febrile infants aged 22 days to 90 days. Now, it did have a sensitivity close to 99%. It was, 98.9% to detect all SBIs. The bottom line from that episode was, quote, "If you have availability of serum procalcitonin measurements in a clinically relevant time frame, the step-by-step approach to fever without source in infants 90 days old or younger is better than using the Rochester criteria or lab score methods, with the caveat that you should be careful with infants between 22 and 28 days old, or those who present within 2 hours of fever onset." End of quote.
And obviously, we're trying to find that sweet spot to balance the consequences of potentially missing an SBI with performing potentially unnecessary procedures, including lumbar punctures, exposing these babies to antibiotics, or prolonging their hospital stay. So this study proposes a new way of trying to identify which infants are low risk between 29 to 60 days based on 3 objective lab criteria.
All right, Dennis, what's the clinical question we're going to try to answer on SGM number 296?
So can a clinical prediction rule or tool using laboratory data identify febrile infants under 60 days of age who are at low risk of serious bacterial infection? That includes urinary tract infection, bacteremia, and bacterial meningitis, and reduce unnecessary lumbar punctures, antibiotic exposure, and hospitalization. Boy, that was a mouthful.
All right, Dennis, what's the reference?
This is by Nate Cooperman et al. It's called a clinical prediction rule to identify febrile infants 60 days and younger at low risk for serious bacterial infections. And this is from JAMA Pediatrics in 2019.
All right. Well, if you've listened to the SGEM, you know we're going to run through a PICO. So what was the population?
The population was febrile infants less than 60 days of age who look good and whose blood cultures were obtained to rule out SBI. And fever was defined as a rectal temperature of at least 38 degrees Celsius.
Yeah, and we need to emphasize that these infants had to look good. They were excluded if they looked critically ill. They also excluded infants who had antibiotics in the previous 48 hours, had a history of prematurity, pre-existing medical conditions, indwelling devices, or soft tissue infections. What was the intervention?
The derivation and validation of an accurate clinical prediction tool for infants at low risk of SBI using a negative urinalysis, an ANC less than 4,090, and a procalcitonin of 1.71 or less.
And so the ANC stands for absolute neutrophil count, and it needed to be less than 4,090. What did they compare it to?
They looked at comparing it to pre-existing algorithms combining subjective clinical findings and lab markers.
And we'll put a table in the show notes that shows the Philadelphia, Rochester, and Boston criteria. How about the outcome?
We were specifically looking at how accurate this prediction rule was in identifying infants at low risk for SBIs, and specifically looking at the sensitivity, specificity, negative predictive value, and negative likelihood ratio.
And the SBI was defined as bacterial meningitis, bacteremia, or a UTI, urinary tract infection.
Right, and they defined UTI a little bit differently. They defined it as a growth of a single urine pathogen with at least 1,000 CFU on culture obtained by suprapubic aspiration, at least 50,000 CFU from a catheterized specimen, or 10,000 to 50,000 CFU from catheterized specimen in association with an abnormal urinalysis, which they defined as the presence of leukocyte esterase, nitrites, or pyuria.
Who knew diagnosing a UTI would be so complicated? All right, let's get to the author's conclusions. Quote, we derived and validated an accurate prediction rule to identify febrile infants 60 days or younger at low risk for SBIs using urinalysis, ANC, and procalcitonin levels. Once further validated on an independent cohort, clinical application of the rule has the potential to decrease unnecessary lumbar punctures, antibiotic administration, and hospitalizations. End of quote. And we have 9 questions as part of the quality checklist for clinical decision tools, and let's run through those now. The first question is, the study population, did it focus on those in the emergency department?
Absolutely, yes.
And were the patients representative of those with the problem?
Yes.
Were all important predictor variables and outcomes explicitly specified?
That would be a yes. Specifically, they looked at age breakdown, whether or not they were less than or equal to 28 days or greater than 28 days, what their temperature was, the duration of fever, a Yale observation score, the clinical suspicion that was broken down into 5 categories, the urinalysis, the white blood cell count, the absolute neutrophil count, and procalcitonin, which was not available to the treating clinicians.
The fourth question was, is this a prospective multi-center study, including a broad spectrum of patients and clinicians?
That would be yes as well. It was prospective, 26 sites in a wide variety of patients or clinicians that were either emergency physician faculty or fellows in general or pediatric emergency medicine.
Clinicians interpreted individual predictor variables and score the clinical decision rule reliably and accurately.
Yes.
Now, was this an impact analysis of a previously validated clinical decision rule?
It was not. This was the first one.
So it wasn't a level 1 study, so question 7 doesn't apply. Question 8, though, the follow-up, was it sufficiently long enough and complete enough?
I don't know if we're quite able to comment on that part.
And the 9th and final question, the effect size, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
We are also can't completely comment on that, and we'll talk more about this in the nerdy section.
All right, before we get to the nerdy section, let's go through the key results. The study included just over 1,800 febrile infants less than 60 days of age who had blood cultures collected. The mean age was 36 days old, 42% were female, 2/3 had a fever of less than 12 hours prior to presentation to the emergency department, median Yale observation score of 6, and serious bacterial infection positive in 9.3%. And of that 9.3%, the vast majority, and what I mean by vast majority is, out of the 9.3, 7.7% was made up of UTIs alone. But what was the key result?
So they derived the low-risk prediction rule based on 3 variables.
All right, what were those 3 variables?
So number 1, a normal urinalysis. Number 2, an absolute neutrophil count of less than or equal to 4,090. Number 3, serum procalcitonin of less than or equal to 1.71.
And you said that the primary outcome was supposed to be the diagnostic accuracy of this. And so what was the sensitivity, specificity, negative predictive value, and negative likelihood ratios?
So we had a sensitivity of close to 98% at 97.7, a specificity of 60%, a negative predictive value of 99.6, and a negative likelihood ratio of 0.04.
And I'll place a table in the show notes so people can see the 95% confidence intervals around those point estimates for the precision of those results. Important to note, there were no infants with bacterial meningitis that were missed in this study.
Right. And there were 1,266 infants that were greater than 28 days of age, And that clinical prediction rule stratified 776 of them, which is 61.3%, as low risk for serious bacterial infection. And of that subgroup, 523, or 67.4%, had a lumbar puncture performed. So this represents the number of lumbar punctures that could have potentially been avoided in this age group for low-risk patients.
So what they're saying is that two-thirds of patients who were in the low-risk stratification could have possibly avoided receiving a lumbar puncture, correct?
That is correct.
All right, well, those are the key results. It's time to talk a little nerdy. And overall, this was a very well-executed study with practice-changing potential. The PCARN group does some great research, and we've covered the very important paper by Nate Cooperman et al. In the New England Journal of Medicine 2018 that looked at fluid infusion rates for children with diabetic ketoacidosis. And that was SGEM number 255.
And Ken, I have to say, I don't typically look at the supplemental material associated with the paper, but this paper's supplemental material is great. But obviously, every study will have some limitations, so we need to highlight some of those now.
We do need to identify some of those limitations, but I have to admit, hi, my name is Ken, and I'm an Uber nerd. I actually pull the supplemental material of all the papers I'm going to do a critical appraisal on, and I read through them because I have a problem. All right, so let's go through the points. I think, we have five. So the first one is about procalcitonin. This study lost a proportion of eligible participants due to procalcitonin sampling issues, 41%. Now, it's difficult to say whether or not this would have changed the result or analysis. The authors state that this group was similar to those with procalcitonin measurements. There is a slight difference in serious bacterial infection positive percentage in those who have procalcitonin test results available compared to those who didn't. It was 9.3% versus 12%.
Additionally, lab tests outside of procalcitonin, like CRP, band counts, and viral studies, were not included in this study. There have been past studies that have demonstrated concurrent viral infection may decrease the risk of serious bacterial infection, but does not exclude it.
So it can decrease the probability or the risk of a serious bacterial infection, but it can't rule it out. Now, procalcitonin samples were centrifuged and frozen at minus 80 degrees Celsius. They batched the samples and then sent them all to a central laboratory. This can increase the precision of the results by decreasing variability. Having 26 different laboratories running procalcitonin levels could introduce more variability into the results. This would potentially decrease the precision by increasing the 95% confidence interval around the point estimate for the diagnostic accuracy of the clinical prediction rule.
To avoid overfitting the data and making the numbers more friendly, they rounded off the ANC to 4,000. But more significantly, they decreased the procalcitonin level from 1.71 to 0.5 to see what would happen with the diagnostic accuracy.
And the sensitivity remained identical, like the same number. And the specificity decreased a little with rounding off the ANC and decreasing the procalcitonin level.
Okay, this is the second point now about defining what a urinary tract infection is. Overall, they followed the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines that we talked about during our PICO discussion, but they did use a lower threshold for colony-forming units, and the reason they cited for this was to account for lower colonies of bacteria sometimes that are found in the urine of younger infants. So this definition actually makes the prediction rule a bit more conservative.
The third point is about younger versus older infants. there was a difference between the two subgroups that they had specified a priori. Overall, 9.3% had serious bacterial infections, but it was 13% in younger infants, and that was in the less than or equal to 28 days of age, versus 7.7% in the older population, infants older than 28 days. Most of the serious bacterial infections were UTIs, which I mentioned earlier. 5 infants had bacteremia and meningitis. 10 infants had UTIs and bacteremia. And 1 poor infant in the equal to or less than 28-day age group had a UTI, bacteremia, and meningitis.
Talk about unlucky. The fourth point we want to make is the number of cases. So we need to be careful about just considering negative predictive value because it is dependent on the prevalence of disease. Likelihood ratios are not dependent on the prevalence of disease. So this study identified 170 infants with SBI, which is 9.3%, which gives a fairly tight 95% confidence interval for negative predictive value. However, there were only 4 cases of bacterial meningitis alone, which is just 0.2%, which can make the negative predictive value look pretty good at 100%, but with a very wide 95% confidence interval.
And we cannot just consider the number of cases identified, but also the number of missed cases. In this study, there were 3 missed cases of serious bacterial infection using the clinical prediction rule. 2 of the missed patients had culture-positive urine without pyuria, and they were in the validation set. 1 patient with a positive blood culture for a bacteria, which I will list in the show note, and it was in the derivation set, but repeated blood cultures prior to antibiotics were never positive. And like I said earlier, there were no cases of bacterial meningitis missed.
We'll take a pause real quick because the other really important part is 4 of these patients had HSV infections, that's herpes simplex. 3 of them had HSV in the CNS, and 1 was in the nasopharynx. This is super important because herpes simplex most often presents in the first month of life.
And the 5th and final nerdy point we're going to talk about is bias. And bias is something that systematically moves us away from the quote-unquote truth, which is the best point estimate of effect. And it's not just random noise in the data. There could have been a number of sources of bias in this study.
One potential bias would be selection bias. To be included in the cohort, these infants had to have blood cultures drawn, which brings up the question, what were the differences in characteristics in those with blood cultures obtained and those infants that did not have blood cultures obtained? Both groups presented to the emergency department with fever. They also enrolled patients when a research coordinator was available, and these two things could have introduced some selection bias.
Another potential bias would be the differential verification bias, or double gold standard. This occurs when the test result influences the choice of the reference standard. So a positive index test gets an immediate gold standard test, whereas the patient with a negative index test gets clinical follow-up for the disease. In this study, only 77% or 3/4 of febrile infants got an LP to rule out meningitis. Those who didn't get an LP had their families contacted by telephone in 1 to 2 weeks after their ED visit and/or reviewed their medical records. This type of bias can either raise or lower sensitivity or specificity. I think we're getting way too nerdy for the SGEMers. So let's compare the author's conclusions to the SGEM's conclusions.
Generally, we agree with the author's conclusions.
Well, Dennis, can you give us an SGEM bottom line for this episode?
So this new clinical prediction rule has the potential to decrease unnecessary lumbar punctures, antibiotic administration, and hospitalizations in febrile infants 60 days and younger at low risk for serious bacterial infections, but needs to be externally validated.
Can you give us a case resolution to that 35-day older?
So you explained to the mother that given her baby's age, she is at risk of SBI. You need to check the blood and urine for signs of infection. And pending those results, you may also need to do a lumbar puncture. The urine and blood samples are obtained and sent for culture. The urinalysis is unremarkable. The blood tests demonstrate that the ANC and procalcitonin are below their respective cutoffs. The patient has taken a bottle in the emergency department and is now afebrile with stable vital signs. You do not administer antibiotics or admit the patient to the hospital. You reassure the mother that it is okay to go home, and she is told to follow up in the next 1 to 2 days with her pediatrician or return to the emergency department if she has any concerns.
And so, Dennis, you're a fellow in pediatric emergency medicine. How are you going to take this new paper and apply it clinically?
I think this is a well-designed and executed study that offers a great way of identifying low-risk febrile infants 29 to 60 days based on objective lab criteria. And again, this clinical prediction rule has three objective lab findings to help identify infants at low risk for SBI and can spare these patients from a lumbar puncture, empiric antibiotics, or hospitalization. There are a couple of caveats I would take away from this particular study. The first is I would not apply this rule to infants that are less than or equal to 28 days. They have a higher risk of infection that includes herpes simplex, which unfortunately this clinical decision rule does not account for. And the second point is that the procalcitonin of less than or equal to 1.71 is the cutoff only when you have a normal or negative urinalysis and a normal ANC. And the last point to make is really that this clinical prediction rule does not replace clinical judgments. If you remember from our exclusion criteria, they actually excluded all the infants that were ill appearing. And in general, these clinical prediction rules should help guide our judgment and not dictate the clinical care. They often have lower diagnostic accuracy and wider confidence intervals when external validation is performed. So this tool should be externally validated, but I actually really like it and use it in my clinical practice.
And so the final thing in this section is, what are you going to tell your patient? And in this case, it'll be the parent or caregiver.
I will usually say to the parent that in babies under the age of 60 days with fever, we always have to think about the possibility of infection. This could be an infection in the baby's urine, blood, or spinal fluid, which coats the brain. I like to start by testing the baby's urine and blood for signs of infection, and then depending on those results, we may need to perform a lumbar puncture to obtain the spinal fluid and give antibiotics or have your child stay in the hospital. We can talk a little bit more after the initial results come back.
All right, it's time to announce the Keener contest winner. Well, that sound means there was no winner last week. The correct answer was years is the pulmonary embolism risk stratification algorithm that has been validated in pregnancy. What's the question this week?
What renal condition is named after the German pioneer of clinical thermometry in the 1800s?
Oh, like, I totally don't know the answer to this Keener question. But if you know the answer of the renal condition named after some German pioneer, that was my best German, of clinical thermometry in the 1800s, if you know who that is, then send an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Now, there are some other FOMED resources on this, and I will list those in the show notes. But I've got to thank Michael Falk for suggesting you come on the show. And I need to thank you for actually coming on the SGEM.
Well, Ken, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, I hope you had a first good experience. And if there's another paper that comes up that you really captures your interest and you think is important, I hope you'll bring it to me and we can do another episode together.
I will take you up on that offer, Ken.
All right, well, Dennis, until that happens, you need to give the SJAM tagline.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.